Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our study of Christianity for Modern Pagans, Pascal's Pensées. It feels like a million years ago, but it was just a few weeks, I guess. So we left off on page 88. And on page 88, there's Pensée 60, which is where we will begin right after our invocation and prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses,
as we forgive
those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, the fun of this chapter and the next is that they are attacking things that we usually think of as the highest nobility, honor, dignity, etc. of man. So human justice is under attack in this chapter. The vanity, the emptiness, and to large degree, impossibility of human justice. And then next chapter, we're going to see Pascal attack human reason, the vanity of human reason. So these are two things that human beings tend to exalt within themselves individually and corporately. Most people think themselves to be just and reasonable, and nothing could be further from the truth. So then, where we left off on page 88, down at paragraph, or 60, I guess, Pensée 60, we're going to see a lengthy pensée and a continued attack on the vanity of human justice. What basis will he take for the economy of the world he wants to rule? Will it be the whim of each individual? What confusion. Will it be justice? He does not know what it is. If he did know, he would certainly never have laid down this most commonly received of all human maxims, that each man should follow the custom of his own country. True equity would have enthralled all the peoples of the world with its splendor, and lawgivers would not have taken as their model the whims and fancies of Persians and Germans in place of this consistent justice. We should see it planted in every country of the world, in every age. Whereas what we do see is that there is nothing just or unjust, but changes color as it changes climate. 3 degrees of latitude upset the whole of jurisprudence, and one meridian determines what is true. All right, that's well said. The fact that what is considered just seems, just from an observational standpoint, to be conditioned upon geography, or not just place, but even time. So in this specific place right now, this is good and this is evil, but if you fast forward 5 years, the whole thing's changed. Or if you take a few steps to the left or to the right, perhaps it's all changed again. So human justice, from that vantage point, seems quite arbitrary and in flux. Now, he's already made some pretty bold claims, and he's going to back them up further in the next paragraph, or next couple paragraphs, so I don't need to. But we will just jump forward at this point. You'll see that Kraft used the superscript A. So if we jump forward to 90, we'll get his commentary on this point. Geography determines opinions about what is just and true. Pascal is not a moral relativist. He does not reduce objective truths to subjective opinions. But he is not a naive idealist either. he clearly sees the relativity of moral opinions to social conditioning. He is demeaning not justice itself, but human justice. A funny sort of justice where limits are marked by a river, end quote. All right, so there is the first critique, and it's a minor critique. I know he's made a bolder claim. So let's continue on with that second paragraph in this Ponce. The very last line and then into the new paragraph. It is a funny sort of justice whose limits are marked by a river. True on this side of the Pyrenees, false on the other. They confess that justice does not lie in these customs, but resides in natural laws common to every country. They would certainly maintain this obstinately if the reckless chance which distributed human laws had struck on just one which was universal. But the joke is that man's whims have shown such great variety that there is not one. Now he is going to really prove his point. Larceny, incest, infanticide, parricide, everything has at some time been accounted a virtuous action. So we need only look at our own country to see that while we have come from a historical standpoint very strong in natural law and trying to reflect that in those of our own country, that has all slid out from under us in the last 60 years or so. And now we have all kinds of protections for things that are grossly immoral and that even other wicked pagan societies would condemn us for. So it's not, again, the critique isn't so much that natural law doesn't exist. Pascal thinks it does. It's just that on account of the wickedness and foolishness of man, this natural law never shines forth truly, but is just variations on messing it up throughout time and place. Thus, the vanity of human justice. Okay, so... yeah, why don't we go over to page 90 and just get points B and C while we're over here. Craved comments. Natural law is not to be found in nations. True justice or natural law is not a lowest common denominator observable in all societies. I mean, sometimes we talk that way, and it's not all that bad to talk that way, but I think the point remains that, strictly speaking, it's not true. It kind of gives you a general idea if you're trying to wrap your mind around natural law and the breadth of it, but Kraft/Pascal's point is well taken that in concrete, that's impossible to demonstrate. Okay, and then C, proof that Pascal is not a relativist, subjectivist, skeptic, or cynic. Human nature tolerates but then rejects injustice as the human body tolerates, but then rejects diseases. Okay, so flipping back over to the Ponce itself then, let's just pick back up with that line, with the paragraph that begins with the word larceny. Larceny, incest, infanticide, parricide, everything has at some time been accounted a virtuous action. Could there be anything more absurd than that a man has the right to kill me because he lives on the other side of the water, and his prince has picked a quarrel with mine, though I have none with him? And isn't that really the nature of all war? And it's ultimately where even just war theories are only helpful insofar as it goes, especially the kind of Augustinian just war theory that's prevailed in the West forever, that Lutherans generally hold to as well. It's true in a very general sort of way, but in a very specific way, it's still ludicrous. One prince may pick a quarrel with another prince for a just cause, and then armies might line up on the banner of that just cause, but it is no less absurd that you end up like quarreling with people that you personally have no quarrel with unto death. So there's an absurdity here of human justice that even extends into what we would normally think of as just wars. All right, Pascal continues. There no doubt exist natural laws. So this is to Krafe's point that Pascal isn't a relativist. That's not his argument. But once this fine reason of ours was corrupted, it corrupted everything. So you can see already he's taking aim at reason, which will be the subject of next chapter. And this, he sounds just like Paul and Luther, and of course Augustine. Custom is the whole of equity for the sole reason that it is accepted. That is the mystic basis of its authority. Anyone who tries to bring it back to its first principle destroys it. The art of subversion, of revolution, is to dislodge established customs by probing down to their origins in order to show how they lack authority and justice. There must, they say, be a return to the basic and primitive laws of the state, which unjust custom has abolished. There is no surer way to lose everything. Nothing will be just if weighed in these scales. Yet the people readily listen to such arguments. They throw off the yoke as soon as they recognize it, and the great take the opportunity of ruining them and those whose curiosity makes them examine received customs. Okay, so I'll do my best to restate the argument. It's really a rather devilish and devious argument that Pascal is noticing, or really rather he's noticing this in other people and then contending that this is a universal human trait. So how do you destroy a particular system or a particular set of customs? You compare it to the objective universal standard of complete and perfect justice, complete and perfect righteousness. Pascal's point is, to which any system fails. But people are so ignorant to this, and they think that that ideal is attainable, that they're willing to rebel and throw out the system when they listen to these so-called prophets. And so this is really the basis, he argues, the quote-unquote rational basis of every rebellion is, hey, there's this ideal, we're not meeting it, let's press for the ideal. All you end up doing is exchanging one perverse system for another perverse system, or one set of errors or failures in attaining the perfect justice, and then receiving a different system that has different errors or failures in terms of attaining the perfect justice. Okay, let's just go a little further and we'll get through this. I know that's a big long one. I know there's multiple points in this argument, but we'll just get through it and then we will pause to see if you have any of your own thoughts or reflections. So just picking back up, maybe we should pick up with D, Krafe's commentary on the bottom of page 90. Revolutionaries can always show the defects in de facto justice or established custom or mores. So by de facto justice, he means justice enacted concretely in a given system. Krafe continues, that is their moral appeal. So revolutionaries can always show the defects in de facto justice. That is their moral appeal. It's why revolutionaries appear to be moral, but rarely are. This, by the way, presupposes and proves the existence in us of a natural law or a de jure justice or true morality. So by de jure, he means like properly speaking or objectively true. So his argument is a subtle one, but it's the fact that we all can recognize how these the revolutionaries and the new customs and mores fall short. We're tacitly acknowledging or implying that there is a standard by which all things are falling short. So the fact that no one attains to it, we still see that there's an it. We still see that there is a natural law. So that's his point here. That this, by the way, presupposes and proves the existence in us of a natural law or de jure justice or true morality, known at least unconsciously, for that is the operative standard by which all revolutionaries judge existing conditions defective. If we did not innately know an ideal better, we would not be able to judge existing conditions as worse. Well, and then you can see, like, largely what even, like, flies under the banner of progressivism, like, what, when does it stop? You achieve one revolution, does it stop? No, progress just keeps marching. So progress just means revolution after revolution after revolution. Like, it just doesn't stop. I mean, who knows? Maybe it goes full circle at some point, or maybe it just marches straight into hell. Who knows? But that's the whole idea, that progressivism leverages this in a never-ending series until finally either it collapses of its own accord or another society brings it to an end. Okay, maybe just this final quip from Kraft is apropos on page 91, the last paragraph before Ponce 81. What follows, the need for deception, is shocking, but seems to follow from the preceding points and from historical example. Do we really think we who believe newspapers and TV are less deceived than our ancestors who believed popes and kings? And of course, that's becoming ever more apparent, especially to younger generations, that we've been lied to en masse for a long time. Okay, so to finish out the previous Ponce, this Ponce 60, let's go back after, so this will be the fourth line from the top of page 90. Pascal continues, that is why the wisest of legislators used to say that men must often be deceived for their own good. And it is largely true. I mean, basically, everything's deception when you start to think about it in these terms. All warfare is deception. All business is deception. Because you're trying to get yourself up a rung. You're trying, so, you know, trying to deceive that it's a good deal when really it's a self-benefiting deal above the neighbor or the rest. But then government becomes this way too. Just, you have to trust us. Are you trustworthy? Never mind that. So this is why the liar Satan has corrupted everything with deceit, and deceit has really, at every single level, sphere, and facet of human society, and it's unavoidable. I mean, that's the nature of falling into sin and into the curse. Okay, so, yeah, the wisest of legislators used to say that men have to be deceived for their own good. The truth about the usurpation must not be made apparent. It came about originally without reason and has become reasonable. We must see that it is regarded as authentic and eternal, and its origins must be hidden if we do not want it soon to end. Okay, so very provoking, very aggressive Ponce here, attacking one of our chief core values, that we think there's such a thing as human justice, and indeed it's quite relative, fickle, and in many cases just a pretense for the opposite. Any thoughts you have on that Ponce, on any of Crafe's or my own comments?
So with this, we know what natural law is, but the what he's talking about in the varying degrees going towards progressivism, would that be referred to what the philosophers call positive law?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hardly an expert in this area, but my understanding is you have natural law distinct from positive law, and positive law is going to be the man-made laws.
Right.
Whereas the natural law is, I mean,
You're separating from the Ten Commandments, basically.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to some extent you are. I don't know that Christianity has frowned entirely upon positive law. There's some positive law that seems unavoidable, but or seems to at least not contradict the natural law. But then, as you're articulating, in many cases, okay, positive law becomes precisely the problem, either because it's perverse or obscures, or laden so much upon the people it becomes ludicrous. I mean, that's maybe the most easy, I think, indictment of our current system, is we have so many laws we don't even know what they are, and we're guilty of them, just waiting to be caught, I guess.
Right? Yeah. It just seems to me that it's hard for us to comprehend the matter of degrees. I'd rather just have natural law is pure and good, and positive laws bad, in a way.
I don't know. Well, I mean, as we've reflected on probably in this class before, if not in some previous class, the more laws on the books, the less righteous the people.
Yeah.
And the more righteous the people, the less laws on the books. I mean, it's commonly observed, and it makes perfect sense, because if you have an internal, if you're a law unto yourself, if you're autonomous, autonomous, then you don't need a bunch of external laws. If you know that there's a God and you're accountable to him, you don't need a policeman to come over and beat you with the billy club, or a teacher to slap your knuckles. Like, you fear God more than you fear that, so you're not even doing that in the first place, right? So the proliferation of laws in our country shows a decline in the morality of our people. So the ideal society would have virtually no laws. We would all be self-governed, and by self-governed, that is, we would all share the biblical morality. I mean, that's really the only way to self-govern. And then where we inevitably step out of line because we're sinful, we have the civil estate to call us back into line or to judge between cases. So, right, the proliferation of all of these of laws, period, but then especially of the positive law, is indicative of a wicked and declining culture. Yes, sir.
Sorry, I'm trying to figure out how to want to phrase my question. If we're given laws like the Old Testament, right, like the Ten Commandments and stuff, how are we to discern which of those are useful for us in discerning objective truth and like implementing that into society? Because there's a lot of laws today, like you mentioned, like, you know, laws regarding abortion that are just immoral. Is there a way to use Old Testament scriptures to that end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. So the most helpful thing to have in mind here, and it's something that President Obama, when he was in office, famously botched. But it's often used by people, pseudo-Christians, or people who aren't Christians but think they're going to use the Bible to do a gotcha on Christians. And that is, they mingle the three kinds of Old Testament law together. So in the Old Testament, there's moral law, the Ten Commandments, with some nuance that we can discuss. Then there's civil law, like what to do if your neighbor's ox gores your ox. And then there's ceremonial law, like don't wear the two different fabrics together, or don't eat pig flesh or shellfish or anything. Okay, so we've got those three spheres of law. Folks like Obama, who want to exploit this, say, well, why should we keep one of the Ten Commandments when you don't keep the regulations about shellfish?
as if that's some gotcha hypocrisy thing. Or, look, you've got poly-blended clothing, and that's forbidden. Ergo, we can violate whichever of the moral commandments we want to violate. So it's conflating these three categories of Old Testament law together and exploiting them in a reductionistic and destructive way. Okay, so when we have those three categories in mind, though, the moral, the civil, and the ceremonial, the moral is binding on account of its universality. And this is really the theology of Romans, where Paul says, like, for those who do not have the law, it's their conscience that accuses or excuses. For those who do have the law, namely the Jews, it's the law along with their conscience that accuses or excuses. But the key being that the same God who created the conscience within us and informs it is the same God who gave the Ten Commandments. And so these things are, at their core, aligned. Now, obviously, we see a deterioration of the conscience of the Gentile to where it no longer is operative. God gives them over to their base desires. So we have to say that. And then we also have to say that when we look at the New Testament, every one of the Old Testament Ten Commandments are repeated in the New Testament, with the exception of the third commandment, because the third commandment, remember, the Sabbath day has in fact been put away, because that has that specific aspect of the old covenant of the ceremonial law to it. But instead, that third commandment gets translated into not, like as the author of Hebrews says, not forsaking the gathering together as some have done. And the spiritual essence of the third commandment, which is come to come and hear God's word, receive it, learn it, not despise preaching, etc. Okay, so only, it's really only that adjustment. I mean, you can quibble about other adjustments, like we no longer have oxes or donkeys or household slaves, like the 10th commandment. We don't, strictly speaking, live in the land, as the fourth commandment gives a promise, but even St. Paul applies that more broadly to Gentiles who obviously don't live in the land. These nuances aside, the core of the Ten Commandments is the core of the natural law or the moral law. It's the content of the conscience when the conscience is rightly ordered. Now, that doesn't mean that we just take the Old Testament ceremonial and civil laws and just say, these are completely positive laws and wacko and weird and we're done with them. We are done with them in the strict sense, that there's nothing binding, but that doesn't mean that they don't reflect the natural law or other theological principles. So we should still take those things into account and consider what wisdom God is communicating. So, for example, in the one with the clothing or the shellfish, often he's making his people distinct from the pagan peoples around them. So on the one hand, no, we don't hold to the letter of that law, but the principle of the law of being distinct from the pagan culture around us, and especially the pagan religions around us, that's an important principle, right? And many of the departure from many of the ceremonial laws, the laws governing the temple, with just this one like kind of ham-fisted dismissal of, well, that's the old covenant, and Christ put that all away. I mean, that has been a recipe in the 20th century for destroying the liturgy or anything else that we don't like, because we just say all of that form is null and void and there's no continuity with the Old Testament. So these things have been highly abused by, again, exploitative people who either know better and are using it deceitfully, or don't know better and really should find a different place to use their vocal cords.
The thing that I've been thinking of about for a while now, but a lot lately even more so, is that it really drills down to the default of our reason. We're adding the layers of complexity because we are wanting to keep us in that godlike layer that we know best. And whenever I look at scientific things, like, well, let's just look at DNA real quick. You know, it drills down to simple amino acids, simple chemicals that are just rearranged that make this wonderful and varied creation. But as Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. Nothing. Nothing. And that means that the layers of complexities that we keep adding as humans in our, you know, I just peeked ahead, you know, we're going to human reason next after this. As we reason our way through things, we are not God. We are far from God. We are his creation. We don't have that ability to reason. Even in the decades that I've now gathered in my life, I'm just about to enter my seventh decade, I look at what my children now, who are adults in their fourth decades, and I recognize how they're thinking, because I used to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be there and think just like them. And so I have a lot more compassion in my heart because God has allowed me to see a few more times walking around the sun and getting more experience. But the bottom line is we add the complexity to it.
Mm-hmm.
We do it, and we're usually dead wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I sometimes reflect on that, that Jesus is the least complicated of all theologians. That doesn't mean he's the easiest, but the least complicated. Yeah, the most simple in the sense in which you're meaning. Yes, please.
I got kind of confused on the last part of the pensis. So is that what we must do or what the legislators must do to deceive us?
Let me try to gain a little more context here.
After the truth.
I'm sorry, where at?
After the dot, 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 the truth.
Yes.
And especially the last sentence.
Okay, so that is why the wisest of legislators used to say that men must often be deceived for their own good. The truth about the usurpation must not be made apparent. That the usurpation is a pretense, right? It's an abuse. It came about originally without reason and has become reasonable. I think that's the sleight of hand indicated. We must see that it is regarded as authentic and eternal, and its origins must be hidden. If we do not want it soon to end. Yeah, so we must see that it is regarded as authentic and eternal when it isn't. And its origins must be hidden because its origins were just some other revolution, some other exploitation. And so we need to hide that if we don't want it to end soon. So, I mean, who the we is just kind of, I think, fallen man, right? Or even kind of just idealizing someone in authority or trying to hold society together in its present state. I mean, conservatism is just trying to hold together the latest revolution in that sense, right? And trying to not let another revolution occur. Whereas the revolutions are just what history does, whether it's internal or external. Does that kind of make sense? Does it resonate with you? I'm hearing that. I mean, it's heavy hitting. It's like Solomon in Ecclesiastes. I mean, it's just taking no quarter. He's being real ornery here. Okay, were there any other thoughts? Or are we ready to move on? Yes, sir.
I was just thinking, you began by saying that geography determines truth, and I'm reminded of a culture in the Middle East that where incest appears to be an accepted norm, you know. And when immigration occurs, that false truth bleeds into other cultures, and I see this as a this is just one example I think of a geographical bleeding out of cultural truth, which is in, you know, which contrasts with objective truth of God. So
yeah,
Do I have that kind of right?
Well, definitely. And I think what we're discovering with the mass immigration and the kind of oil and water don't mix, however you want to define oil and water, is that our belief that morality is simply a matter of educating someone into it is a false belief. You're not going to educate someone into our morality when they don't believe it in the first, and they'll never believe it. Yeah. So that shows that, technically the language would be empires, a governing authority over many nations within it or underneath it, like we have in America. You're going to find nations that are more compatible with one another and less compatible with one another. So we've already seen that. I mean, less compatible. This should be low-hanging fruit. Nations that are less compatible with, well, Muslim nations that have come into our country and set up shop and are just biding their time until they can take over and have Sharia law. I mean, that's a nation that's much less compatible on the spectrum than, say, the Japanese nation or something. And we have Japanese immigrants who come in and they may not be, you know, fully American melting pot style, or they may not have conformed fully to culture, but they don't pose the same level of dissonance or threat that an Islamic culture would pose or an Islamic nation would pose as it immigrates within. So now, I mean, these things are self-evidently true. They're just obviously true. But what I'm saying right now is also highly and explosively what? Racist. And so you can see that this is exactly where racism is a, like, it's not racist. It's just the way God has made the world. Or you can even say it's the way sin has affected the world. And it's just common sense, easy and understandable for any child. But we refuse because we bought into this false religion and this false morality. And it's exactly in this way that racism is a false sin in most cases. Now, there are times in which I'm sure there's a kind of hatred of neighbor that you could label as racism and say that's truly against God's word. But it's not against God's word to say this Muslim nation and this non-Muslim nation, of the two, one is more compatible with the American nation than the other. That would be deemed racist by the leftism in our nation. But it's not racist. It's just an observation of truth and fact. And it'll bear itself out in time if we don't do anything about it.
But this is also a two-way street. You know, there was a movie back in the day that was called The Ugly American. And we export our geographic customal truths wrongly to other countries. For example, divorce. And so we are viewed, you know, you go into divorce is accepted, and we have such a high rate here. So it's, I can see where Satan is active on a two-way street in moving these wrong norms around.
Yeah, absolutely. Where we have exported our immorality, that's not been a great thing. And the hubris of us as Americans is that in exporting our immorality, we think we're liberating them. I mean, this is where, not that I think Putin's a wonderful guy. I mean, there, now I've been racist and pro-Russia here all at once. But this is one of the most indicting and convincing critiques that Putin makes of the West, is he says, what do we want with your immorality, your instability, your anti-Christianity? Like, what do we have to do with that? I don't know. Difficult to argue with that sentence or two that came out of his mouth, you know, so...
A blind squirrel finds a nut.
What's that?
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut.
Yeah, exactly. That's well said. Yeah, yeah. So, right, this is, this is the world in which we live in. I think Pascal and anyone before the 20th century brainwashing that occurred in the West just knew these things, and these things were self-evident. And now you're a great sinner if you agree with these people who came before us. But that's just what we'll have to bear in order to be sane. Okay, any other thoughts? So, yes, please.
something that just keeps, you know, and yet God confused our languages at the Tower of Babel.
There was a time when we were all one, and yet he did that for a real reason, because we were getting too close. I mean, maybe I misunderstand that whole incident.
Yeah, well, it's become a controversial, a kind of controversial topic. But very clearly in Genesis 10 and 11, Genesis 10 comes first for a reason, because Genesis 11 takes place within the history of Genesis 10. So as Moses so often does, he does like a large frame, small frame. Remember, God makes man and a woman in his image, male and female. He created them, Genesis 1. And then Genesis 2, you get the zoom in of that, and you find out that God didn't just zap Adam and Eve together at the same time by speaking, but rather he took the man and formed him out of the earth and breathed into him the breath of life, and then later on took the woman from, right? So you get this like this big 40,000 foot frame and then this narrow tight frame. And that's exactly how Genesis 10 and 11 work. Genesis 10 is the big frame of all the nations of the earth, the fulfillment of the command that God had asserted to Adam, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. He reasserted that to Noah and his sons after the flood. Be fruitful, multiply, and do what? Fill the earth and subdue it. Not all lumped together into a single little geography around a tower where you're going to, you know, presumably storm heaven, access the gods. I mean, some even think that, I don't know if I really buy this, that they think they were building a tower so they could survive the next flood. So next time God tries to wipe them out, they're safe up high. I don't know if they really thought that. But in any case, the nations and distinctions in among nations are part of God's good and godly order. It's what he himself created. Deuteronomy 32 shows this. Acts 17 shows this. So nations are, and diversity of peoples spread out amongst geography is all good and all part of God's plan. And it's, in fact, it's so good and so part of God's plan that when God gives us visions of the new heavens and the new earth, when we're all resurrected in our bodies and in the new holy city, we retain our ethnicities and our distinctions. Like, we don't all suddenly become white or suddenly become black or suddenly become Chinese or something like that in the new heavens, the new earth. But what do we see? People of every tribe and language and tongue and however else the rest of that goes are all gathered around the throne. And also the nations themselves, the wealth of the nations are gathered in. So it's like, what's a nation if they've all been erased? So the nations and the distinctions amongst peoples are all part of God's good creation. But yes, on account of that sin of the Tower of Babel, he strikes their languages. Even then, you sometimes hear, like, this is how crazy we've gotten, that that Pentecost is sort of this reversal of Babel. Well, it's not. If it was a reversal of Babel, we'd all be speaking the same language after Pentecost. Rather, it's a reaffirmation of the diversity when the Holy Spirit inspires the apostles to speak in all the different tongues of all the different people gathered there. Did you have a follow-up on?
Just the fact that they all speak in tongues in the same way.
So this is, not even real human languages in the main, right? So, yeah, these are real human languages. Yeah, so a lot of what we see Satan doing right now is going back to Genesis like it's a playbook and attacking it piece by piece. So what's the first thing God does? He doesn't create a human being. He creates a man and a woman. So the first thing he attacks is that identity of the individual. You're just a human being. You can choose to be a man or choose to be a woman, you see? That's Satan's fundamental attack on the individual. But a second attack is really that the individual exists in and of itself and apart from a collective. Is that how it works? If that were how it worked, then God would in fact zap Adam into creation and then zap Eve into creation, but he doesn't. He takes the woman from the man. And then does he just take the child and zap the child into creation? No, that would be individualism, exclusive individualism. But the child is precisely the one flesh product of the man and the woman. Through their co-creation, the child comes into existence. So the only individuals that exist exist within collectives. That's exactly how God himself is. He is, in a sense, the individual, the one, and a collective, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And the individual persons, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, don't exist in a vacuum and can't exist in a vacuum. A father can't be a father without a son. And the Spirit can't be a spirit that is spirated without one who spirates. And so the internal logic of God's own person reflects itself in creation, which is why human beings, like, I can't say, strictly speaking, that I'm an individual, because I consist of what? My father and mother's genes. And all of our collective experience together. So nature and nurture. And the same is true for all of us. This idea that you can just exist as a zapped into ex nihilo, zapped into creation human being doesn't work. So then, understanding that we are not only created by God as male or female, and that the female is created for the male, from the male for the male, and that through this one flesh union and through this one flesh union alone, God brings new human beings. You can see how Satan hates every part of this. He hates and attacks every part of this, and tries to convince us that we're individual autonomous units is what I'm trying to say. They can do whatever we want, and we're androgynous, and we can be whatever we want. And then that we exist in a world apart from family structure, which is impossible. It's why our politics have become so heated that, like, our children, you know, children won't even, like, they disown their parents because their parents voted for Trump or something. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But, I mean, we should expect that, because church members are disowning each other if they find out you voted for Trump, too. So be wary of that. You get disowned over politics. So this religious principle is more important than any bonds of flesh or spirit in this new satanic religion. So it goes down to the destruction of the whole family in this way, the destruction of childbearing through birth control. Of course, if it can be prevented in the first place, great. And if not, and it happens, then there's abortion. And if not, it happens, you try to recruit to your side in the spiritual warfare. That's Satan's threefold plan there. And then it extends out. Communities are completely disintegrated because we have spread out to where we send all our people to the cities. And so demographics and diversity are completely melted down by this system and destroyed. That's all his, I mean, Satan would love nothing more than we all live in giant wicked cities, like little larvae in some sort of, you know, beehive, yeah, or ant's nest or whatever, and that you will own nothing and be happy. You'll just be human batteries for the uber wealthy who will tell you what to believe. And of course, these people are wicked and satanic. And then you just keep following that out, the disintegration of local communities, the disintegration of any kind of coherent stability of a society or culture or even a congregation or church. All of that's under attack. And then, the last form or bastion of that is nations, that nations themselves don't exist. So you get this whole idea it's infected conservative Christianity too. Quote-unquote conservative Christianity, this idea that we're just all one race, the human race, and any idea that there could be nationalities, distinct ethnicities that one could recognize as verboten, as racist or something, when the Bible itself talks this way. The language of nation in the Bible is ethnicities, ethnos. And the language of nation is the language of natal, where you were born. So it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, have exclusive nations per se, but it does mean that if we deny these things, then we're going to I'll grab you one second. If we deny these things, we're going to be doing something contrary to what the Bible does. We're going to be viewing the world in a way that the Bible doesn't view it. We're also going to be missing out on Satan's holistic attack, how he's trying to dissolve the entire human being from the individual all the way down to the nation, with the whole point of reordering it so that we're all disconnected to everything except for Satan via the few tiny little elite leaders that he sets in charge over the whole thing. Yes, sir.
I think that some on the left, they speak out of both sides of their mouth. At the one hand, they'll say, oh, yeah, there's no, you know, we're all one, et cetera, and so on. And yet all the government forms for school, for jobs, want to know what race you are, what ethnicity you are, and what skin color you are. And so they have all this breakdown of race.
Mm-mm.
So you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great point. I mean, they don't really care about, and we're picking on the left. I'm not sure the American right or the quote-unquote neoconservatives or conservatives are all that much better. It's just relative. But you don't need a coherence in your ideology. You just need to win. And if you can win by baffling people with an incoherent, then all the better. Or if you just say there's no such thing as coherency in any case, it's all relative, then you're just making relative arguments contextually in a will to power, right? I'm just overcome. That's why we get the Bible thrown back in our face. Is it because they believe it or think it's an authority? No, they just want to try to destroy us with it. So it's a complete just will to power with nothing else there other than all conversations and arguments are a means to an end, and the end is dominance. So the by and large, the conservatives are trying to go along with this because of our commitments to not liberalism in the narrow sense, but liberalism in the broad sense. This is where truly the two parties are just two sides of the same coin, and that coin is liberalism. And then what we've seen is the radical left breaking off from that social contract and really becoming something new. And this is where you had like old school narrow liberals suddenly looking very conservative. Joe Rogan, Bill Maher, some of these other figures, because they're realizing that the new left is radically opposed to the liberalism in which liberals and conservatives once existed. So anyway, all of this is a relativistic mess, but the point being, for us as Christians, we want to realize what Satan is doing and how he is attacking and using whatever he can to attack in order to create a new religion in our midst and a new global religion. That's really his end goal. And of course, he's doing that through other means and modes too. I mean, religions have to be dissolved. The distinctions between religions have to be dissolved. So you see ecumenism. Roman Catholicism, the largest global Christian denomination, has become in the last 75 years wildly ecumenist, whereas previously it wasn't. I mean, previously, yeah, Vatican II changed everything. Prior to Vatican II and earlier, you had denunciations of other religions. What is the Pope saying now? I mean, it's not just what he's saying, it's what he's doing. He's building a prayer space for Muslims in the Vatican. So what's going on there? A dissolving of the hard lines and ecumenism that unites all religions. Because religions like nations, or like families, can stand against ideology. So the Rohde family will stand up against ideology. If there's a tyrannical ideology, we'll take up arms, we'll do what we have to do. If that's where we die, that's where we die. But if there's no such thing as the Rohde family, because we've all been dissolved and scattered and spread about, well, there's no threat. Similarly, people will bleed for the blood and soil that is their nation. But if there is no nation, or the nation's been so diluted that it's unrecognizable, people no longer will stand up. I mean, that's where you get this rhetoric of like, well, our forefathers wouldn't put up with this. What did they do? They dumped out the tea for a 3% tax increase or something. Here we are paying 30%. Well, we're not our fathers. That's precisely the nature of this, is it's all been eroded away. The nation's been destroyed. So, well, then people will stand up on religious basis. They'll say, I'm a Roman Catholic, or I'm a Lutheran, and I'm willing to die for that, and I'm willing to stand shoulder to shoulder with other Lutherans, or shoulder to shoulder with other Roman Catholics, or shoulder to shoulder with other Christians. Well, not if that's all been dissolved into a mishmash of Islamo-Christianity Judaism, then you won't stand up at all. And that's the erosion of the religious affiliation association. So you can see how Satan is dissolving all of these things with the poison of radical egalitarianism in order to destroy any mode or means by which human beings would find camaraderie and stand up against the beast. And since we won't, the beast will prevail. So that's how it's going.
I think you find that entering even so-called Protestantism today, evangelicalism, you'll find many of them say, oh, well, we don't consider ourselves evangelical or Protestant. We're just Christian.
Yeah.
And they want to put down any discussion of any differences. And they say, well, we all agree on the basics. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
And even Lutherans, some Lutherans will say, well, they're different Lutherans, but we're all Lutheran.
Yeah. I mean, that's Rick Warren was like the greatest ecumenist, the most popular ecumenist in evangelicalism. And he would go around the world and try it with his ecumenistic false gospel. And then likewise, I mean, he's deeds, not creeds, doctrine divides, all those slogans are his. The papacy, likewise, basically anyone can end up in heaven as long as you're not Lutheran. You look at, think of the ecumenism that took place in the 80s between the Lutherans, and here it's not the LCMS, God be praised, but virtually the, Wells is excluded too, but virtually the rest of the Lutherans and Rome, they signed this document that is the JDDJ, the Joint Declaration of the Doctrine of Justification. So in other words, we all got through the Reformation, we're at peace with each other. I mean, it's nothing but equivocation. Like, it's like, oh, we all believe that we're saved by grace. And Rome's like, yeah, but we define grace this way. And the Lutherans are like, okay, whatever. So there's been ecumenism afoot for decades trying to meld and unite all the churches into one big hodgepodge. And then where do you think Judeo-Christian came from? All you have to do is pick up any Christian writing prior to the 19th century and see what they say about Jews. There is no Judeo-Christian, and the Jews are the enemies of Christianity on account, not on account of their race, but on account of their false religion. Okay, and so then on account of their false religion, they're enemies, and now we're told that there's nothing but Judeo-Christian, and if you don't support Israel, if you don't support Netanyahu, you can't be a Christian. You're not going to heaven. That's literally where we're at. Like, if you don't submit to the murderous, tyrannical current modern day Israel, you can't go to heaven. So, yeah, well, we'll just have to be anti-Semitic then.
Follow Luther.
What's that?
Follow Luther.
Yeah. I mean, this is ridiculous, right? That's why you can't be racist, you can't be anti-Semitic, you can't be contrary to other religions or other denominations, because Satan needs it all to meld in together into one big thing that can't fight him. So, yes, sir.
Perhaps this is a little off topic, but what should ecumenism look like? What should ecumenism look like, if not giving up your own beliefs for the sake of becoming one?
Yeah, I think the best model of ecumenism is, in the first place, you're trying to come to terms in the way of objective truth. So dogmatically, there is no easy way. And dogmatically, that level of ecumenism may be impossible. So you may not be able to reunite.
Magisterially, like from the top down.
Yeah, at a doctrinal level, yeah. Right? But the doctrines can't be conceded. They have to actually, like, one side has to be convinced that it's in error and come over to the other side. That's the only way. Now, in terms of the next level, which is like, in what sense can we cooperate in externals? That's been the language in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And there, it's not so easy to know when and how. I mean, obviously, we would unite with all other Christians against abortion or something like that, right? So there are very clear examples where cooperation in externals are very important.
Would you call missions or like ministry an external to a certain extent, like supporting the poor or?
So yeah, social ministries as to try to make a distinction, supporting the poor, feeding the poor has been acceptable. Mission work per se, like sharing the gospel, not because you're giving a false impression, right? As if we're all the same or we're all in agreement when we're not. So that's been a dividing line. But that that in terms of like the social work or the social mission has gotten us in trouble too as of late. I mean, this is going to come out in the judgment seat. I don't have to convince you of it now, but if you want to go digging, you'll go find it. And that is the LCMS's participation in the NGOs. We've been called out by name by public figures along with other Lutherans because Lutheran social services and these other broader social organizations that we've cooperated with because they're externals have done, maybe they've done some good things too. I'm not trying to distort it in any way. But some of what they've done has been grotesque. Trafficking children into homosexual couple homes, subverting entire populaces by massively immigrating in Somalians, destabilizing a nation that already exists, and profiting hugely all the way through, taking it to the bank. So talk about selling out your own flesh and blood. Talk about child trafficking. Talk about these kinds of things that our hands are not completely clean of. Because we've participated in these organizations. We've still to this day, I think, on some of these organizations got our little LCMS logo attached to their websites. I mean, how can that be? So there's a kind of ecumenism in externals even that has gone awry and that I'm not sure any church body in America has had its hands clean of that whole debacle. So... But don't come at me about that stuff. I don't care. I'll concede. You can just wait for the judgment. The Lord will prosecute that one. I don't need to. All right. That's all the time we have today. So we will pick up next week back at page 91. And we're going to try to get a little further ahead next week. I promise. It's the new year, so we have to restate these things for 2026. Let's try to go to 91, and let's just say we're going to go to 101 before that great big Ponce starts there. So the very top of 101. The Lord be with you.